You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
Radio New Zealand has revealed that the SIS has carried out operations with the British MI6 involving embassies of Eastern Bloc countries in Wellington during the 1980s, including one at the Czechoslovakian embassy in 1986. Breaking into foreign embassies is a breach of Article 22 of the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, which outlined that, quote, the premises of the mission should be inviolable and the host country is not allowed to enter them. What that means is the host country, like New Zealand, is not even allowed to open mail or the diplomatic bag, which is a container with special legal protections that is used to carry official correspondence for the foreign country. Auckland University's law lecturer Anne Hertogen said if the SIS MI6 raid in 1986 were discovered, the operatives would be handed to New Zealand courts, because contrary to popular belief, the Czech embassy is not part of The embassy is not part of the territory of the sending state. International law allows states to criminalise behaviour outside of its territory if this behaviour goes against the vital interests of the state. If Czechoslovakia had such a law, they could perhaps have started a claim on that basis, but that would still need it to be able to get the agents before their courts, and that's a different matter. They wouldn't have authority to arrest people in New Zealand. Most likely, if the Czechoslovakian authorities have found that at the time and had wanted to give this publicity, that would have been a major diplomatic embarrassment for New Zealand, and the representative to Prague, assuming that Wellington had one in 1986, might have been summoned for the Czech foreign minister for an explanation, or maybe expelled. But in this hypothetical scenario, eventually the parties would probably have reached to some diplomatic solution. However, there are still legal consequences for a state to breach Article 22. As with any obligations under international law, if the Vienna Convention is breached, an injured state, in this case Czechoslovakia, can ask for repatriations. If that fails, the injured state can take countermeasures, which they can suspend an international law obligations towards the other state. In other words, they can break international law, and the other state, in New Zealand in this case, would not be able to claim that this is a wrongful breach of international law. So this event is interesting on a couple of points. From what was the Soviet Union doing in New Zealand, and most importantly, should the public now be able to know more about these operations, given that more than three decades have passed? And I discussed these questions with Dr. Rhys Ball, who is a lecturer in security studies from Massey University.
The Soviet Union was, again, you know, we go back to the start of the Cold War, which sort of takes place or kicks off pretty much after the Second World War sort of finishes. And for most political studies historians, students of that particular sort of era or time, they'll know that the world was essentially sort of divided into two basic sort of ideologies. Western democratic market force sort of led democracies, principally driven by the United States and, of course, the United Kingdom, of which members of the Commonwealth, including Australia and New Zealand and Canada, were part of, versus socialism and communism and the ideologies that were being sort of pushed by the Soviet Union and its satellite states. And we have this situation where there is this global competition that is binary in its broadest sense, and I'm oversimplifying things here, but there is this competition, you know, and it takes place both in a cold sense, hence the Cold War, but also hot with various sort of proxy conflicts that sort of take place in various regions around the world, whether that be sort of Africa or Asia. So sort of the Korean War and the Vietnam War were sort of classic examples of that Cold War competition actually sort of going hot. Now, in order for those two ideologies to convince other parts of the world of the value and the importance and that sort of thing, they spent time influencing or trying to sort of convince certain states of the value of what they were doing or what they believed in. And so the Soviet Union had a significant, a set of foreign policy sort of objectives, which included having presence in the Western sort of world to further their political ideals, but also in competition with Western sort of democracies and the Western alliance to see whether they could procure secrets or sensitive information, which would give them a sense or a better understanding of the West's attitude towards the Soviet Union, who traditionally and historically has been sort of quite sort of paranoid, sort of worried about sort of being invaded or taken over. And you could argue rightly so. Everyone's tried to sort of take them on or invade them over the sort of, the last three or four centuries. So that's the sort of the scene that we see. That's setting the scene of the sort of the Cold War. And so it's an extension of this great power competition. And so the Soviet Union is in New Zealand because, quite simply, New Zealand is part of that, part of the sort of the Western English-speaking alliance of sort of countries that were part of the Allied sort of forces post sort of Second World War, and it carries on. New Zealand is part of a very close set of relationships between the other sort of four countries that we now know as sort of five, so the United States, the United Kingdom, Canada, and Australia. So the Soviet Union view was we need to access information or secrets or intelligence from the United States and the United Kingdom. So, and if New Zealand and Australia are talking to the United States and the United Kingdom, might that be an easier way to access some of that information that we need or we're interested in?
And but cases of espionage in New Zealand, like being very public, is very unheard of. But has it happened before?
Public, you know, awareness of espionage or intelligence sort of activity is the exception rather than the rule. Most intelligence organisations would prefer that their activities and their operations remain sort of secret and unheard of. So usually you will find that when we do hear about espionage cases, it's usually some sort of failure or disclosure or unauthorized or authorized. And in some cases we see after a set period of time that information is declassified, so that we as historians or intelligence sort of studies specialists can sort of have a look and have a closer appreciation of that sort of activity, and where intelligence fits in a broader national security or foreign policy sort of component as part of broader sort of international relations and geopolitical sort of relations, because states are quite keen to protect their secrets, some more than others. And so the objective there is to try and sort of identify or get access to those secrets. And the intelligence services are sort of the trained sort of specialists to gather that information. So you do see examples of espionage taking place in New Zealand, but not very often.
And the Radio New Zealand's podcast outlining the raid on the Czechoslovakian embassy got me thinking into some operational aspects of the SIS. So I might want to know, like, what factors do the SIS take in when they plan an operation? For example, will they take in possible ramifications and, like, potential breaches of the Vienna Convention into consideration, or they just do anything to get the job done?
Yes. Well, I wouldn't necessarily consider or classify or use the word raid, because raid sort of smacks of a very overt thing. So again, intelligence services are very good at practicing covert activity. Like I said, they don't like people knowing what they're doing. And why do they do that? Well, you know, if somebody knows you've been spied on, then they're going to take precautions to make sure that their secrets are protected even more. So the objective of the exercise is to steal those secrets without anybody knowing that the secrets have been stolen. And so intelligence services, and I won't go into any sort of specific detail about SIS, but we can sort of say intelligence services on the whole, when they sort of think about what they're looking for and who they want to get it from, will carry out some pretty thorough risk assessments and think about sort of various contingencies before they go and carry out an operation. And that sort of that includes from the tactical or the operational sort of side of things, how you actually get that intelligence or information. And there are a variety of ways in which intelligence services and the various intelligence methodologies that are available can be used, all the way up to, again, getting clearance from senior decision makers and policy makers, government officials, prime ministers and presidents in some cases, depending on the sensitivities related to those operations and the potential implications should that operation be discovered or disclosed. And at that point is when, and again, I just sort of simplify things here, you get the thumbs up or the thumbs down. So in answer to your question, yes, SIS or any other sort of organisation will do a complete and thorough appreciation of the operation and what they want, and they will balance that with the value of the intelligence that they are likely to get as a result of that operation.
Former Prime Minister Jeffrey Palmer told Radio New Zealand that he thinks protective security requirements should be reviewed, so the record should be available to historians and others, often a lapse of time. And that was echoed by Veronica Schmidt and Tim Watkin from Radio New Zealand, who have said these historical operations is in the public interest. So as a former intelligence officer and now an academic, do you think we should have these conversations on these old operations that happened possibly 30 years ago?
If you ask me with my old intelligence hat on, I would say yes and no. You've got to be a little bit sort of circumspect and perhaps what we see is more historic events. You find that agencies and governments are a bit more sort of willing or comfortable to release that information or declassify that information. Because, you know, time has gone by, a sufficient amount of time has gone by that there isn't going to be any repercussions sort of there, bearing in mind that, you know, most countries were involved in this sort of activity. The historian in me or the academic says, yeah, absolutely. I think it's important to understand why states engage in this sort of activity and what value that it sort of provides, but we also need to have some balance in the sort of debate. Every time we mention SIS or GCSB, there's this immediate reaction of state surveillance or unauthorized sort of spying and espionage, and I don't think that's that's valid or credible. There's a reason why these organisations are around and have been around for a while, and as far as I can see, they're not going away anytime soon. So having an understanding of what they do, why they do things, and what happened in the past when the context was perhaps very different, gives us an understanding and an appreciation of, you know, the value and the importance of these organisations moving forward.
The Wire.
Sitting on the beach watching transnational criminal scum neoliberal filth.
That was me talking to Massey University's Rhys Ball about espionage in New Zealand during the Cold War. Former Prime Minister Sir Geoffrey Palmer has claimed the Soviet KGB has tried to penetrate government systems and infiltrate the Labour Party during the Cold War, while former Prime Minister Helen Clark and current SIS Minister Andrew Little has refused to rule out having signed off foreign embassy break-ins.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.